Hello, I'm B'nai Naudin, and this is The Process. Have you ever wondered about the Peace Corps? Perhaps you know it, perhaps you don't. Have you ever wondered what people actually do in the Peace Corps? Who they are? Why they do it? Well, let me first give you a little primer. Peace Corps was established in 1961 under the Kennedy administration. And to date, over 240,000 people have served, American citizens. They've served in 142 countries in all to date.
The Peace Corps is an independent agency within the U.S. government. It's not part of the State Department, and this independence is currently under threat. The way it works is that countries wishing to have Peace Corps volunteers make the request to the U.S. government, and based on their needs, define what they want volunteers to focus on. Currently, volunteers work in the following sectors: agriculture, environment, community economic development, health, education, and youth and development. The mission of the Peace Corps is to promote world peace, friendship, and understanding by focusing on three goals. The first is to help people of interested countries in meeting their need for trained men and women. The second is to help promote a better understanding of Americans on the part of the people served. And the third is to help promote a better understanding of other peoples on the part of Americans.
Currently, I guess there are 61 countries that have Peace Corps volunteers. The vast majority are women. My guest today is not female, but is really kind of special because he served 5 times in the Peace Corps, and I just find that pretty incredible. So get ready for a slightly longer episode where you will find out more about the Peace Corps and what people can do. Here goes nothing. Honobada.
Jamtan.
Tana ala.
Jamtan.
Hono golede.
Jamtan bivoni.
Yo. All right, I'm here with Paul Menard, who has the distinction of having served in the Peace Corps 5 different times. Paul, how long had you known about Peace Corps before becoming a volunteer?
It was about 20 years. It took 20 years.
So you had heard about it and it sort of percolated in your mind, or was it, you know, at a particular period of time that you decided that perhaps you might apply?
What happened was I had had a friend who had been a volunteer in Zaire, now the Democratic Republic of Congo, in the early 80s. And she would sit down and she would just tell me of her experiences. And it just lit a fuse in me that I had to, you know, also when I had the opportunity to join.
So you applied?
Yes, I did. Yep.
And what year was that?
Oh, it was 2000, year 2000, early 2000, February 2000, I believe.
Okay. And what was the application process like?
Oh, it was you just applied, and then you put down 3 different choices at the time. Okay. And it didn't mean that you were going to get any of them, and I didn't. So
what were your 3 choices? Sorry to interrupt, but what were your 3 choices?
Yeah, I believe the first 3 choices, I think, was in Asia, Thailand, and in that area. I don't remember the other two, but I remember Thailand was the first one.
So what did you end up getting?
I ended up getting El Salvador, which I was glad that I had been accepted, but I was kind of shocked when I saw El Salvador. I'm like, where is El Salvador?
So you looked at a map?
Yes, I did. And I found El Salvador. And then I also remember that it had been, it was in the news because of the war they had. So, you know, I did have some knowledge of El Salvador, but not as much as I did afterwards, after doing a little bit of more research on it.
So you accepted the offer. Were you happy about accepting the offer, or were you still kind of bummed out you weren't going to Thailand or wherever else you had wanted to go?
Yeah, I was. I mean, I must admit, I was a little disappointed in not getting Thailand. I accepted it because I did want to go into the Peace Corps. But I did learn that afterwards that I was wrong, because I had a great time in El Salvador.
Yeah. So before you actually joined, what were you doing?
I was actually working in a nursery, and I had been doing some IT work. And so I was kind of in flux with work, and I was ready to move.
Uh-huh. And how was your family? How did they like the idea of you going away?
To them, they were really occupied with their life. Everybody was younger. Now my family's a little bit older and people were retired, but everybody was in their thing. And my family knew me, and I was just Paul, and Paul did what Paul did, and that's what they were just basically used to it.
So you went to El Salvador. Where in El Salvador did you serve, and in what capacity?
I served in the Department of Sonsonate, which is about an hour outside of San Salvador, the capital. It was in the agroforestry sector.
Can you repeat the department? What was the name of it?
Sonsonate. S-O-N-S-A-N-A-T-E.
Okay. And so where was that? Was that in the center of the country? What part of the country was it in?
It was in, I would say, the northwest, I would say.
Mm-hmm. And what was the environment like? Were you in a small town, a village, a city?
Yeah, I was in a village of 300 people.
Uh-huh. What was the housing? And can you describe the place a little bit?
Yeah, it was in the... El Salvador is somewhat mountainous and hilly, but this was in a flat plain area. And the housing was a regular regular mud brick house with a tin roof.
Was it very hot?
Yeah, it was pretty hot. No electricity, so there was no fans. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, it got hot.
Mm-hmm. And were there, how many seasons did they have?
They had two. The dry season and the rainy season.
And how rainy was the rainy season?
It was interesting. It seemed like almost by your clock at 6 o'clock at night, you could see the clouds coming over the hills. And by 7 o'clock, everything was finished. And mostly it was like that.
Okay, so it was only like an hour a day at most.
Yes.
And like clockwork. How interesting.
Yeah, it was. It was really. You could just sit back and.
And remind me what your role was.
I was in agroforestry, but you know what I found in my Peace Corps experience is that you're in a specific sector, but you also ended up to be doing a lot of community development work at the same time.
Tell me a little bit about your job in agroforestry and the activities you did outside of that.
In the village I was in, it had been a sugarcane field. So when the people moved in, it was only like five trees in an area of about almost 220 acres. So there was a need to get trees, to get shade and fruit trees and all that. So there was actually a need to do trees, and we started little nurseries.
What kind of trees were you working with?
All kinds, fruit, almond trees, neem trees. And all that, and we ended up doing a lot. We ended up planting a lot of trees.
And with this rainy season, that obviously helped when you transplanted the trees.
Yeah, it did. It did. We were able to plant it so that when we planted, it was right at the beginning of the rainy season. So after 6 months, they were pretty much established, and most of them, almost all of them, lived. It was really pretty good, pretty easy.
Wow. How many trees did you end up planting, do you think?
Oh, I don't know. But it may be close to 1,000, because okay. It was a lot.
And who were you working with doing that? Was it with a nonprofit, or were you just working with your villagers? How did that sort of come about?
I started working with an NGO, but after the NGO did something wrong in the village, and basically the village kicked them out after 2 months. So I ended up, took me a month or two, because my Spanish wasn't too good, to find another counterpart in there. And once I did that, I found a village counterpart, and we were able to move along pretty well.
And these trees were planted where exactly?
Well, all right, around their fields, around the school, around the soccer field, inside their residences. Anywhere that anybody wanted a tree and there was a space, he planted them.
Okay. And how involved was Peace Corps, country director or your trainers? How involved were they in helping you out, or, you know, how did that go?
Well, this was the Peace Corps of 2000, and I found that it was different in 2000. There was no cell phones, and, you know, being in contact was a little bit more of a challenge than, later on when cell phones were more prominent. But in general, they let me go, let us go out there, let us do our work, and, you know, we would go into the Capitol, and they would come and do a visit every so often. But, you know, they were pretty much hands-off, but any support that we needed, we just contacted them, and they were right there.
Okay. And so you had training before you set out to your village. What was the training like?
The training, well, it was basically, of course, starting tree nurseries, grafting, that type.
Mm-hmm.
Language and training, of course.
Uh-huh. And how was your language ability when you got to the village?
Well, I was older. I was an older volunteer, so they tell me that the older you are, it's more difficult to learn languages. So it was really basic. It was trying. The first several months were really a trying time, but in time it worked.
Okay, what kind of additional projects did you do?
Well, we ended up working with regular gardens, vegetable gardens.
Mm-hmm.
Ended up collaborating with the school. Did some basic health. Supported girls' soccer teams. Trying to get the police more integrated and comfortable with the village. Having soccer games between the local police department and the villages. And
so there had been tension with the police. Is that related to the war, or is that just related to policing in general?
It was related to the war. There was a lot of mistrust between each. And I was happy enough to run into a lady who was actually involved with outreach from the police department in the local town. Somehow, I can't remember how. But then we were talking, tried to work on, and the best thing we could think of was to come up with a soccer game between the local police department and the villagers, and it worked out really well.
So then the villagers and the police people, was it all men?
Yeah, it was all men. Yeah, yeah. It was the village men soccer team against the... At that time, there were no girls soccer teams in the villages in that area.
Okay, so continuing with the police, so after that game, did they acknowledge each other? Did bonds sort of form with the police and the villagers, or was it just a cordial, relationship, sort of distant relationship, or did you see more warm friendship happening?
I did. When I first told the villagers that they were going to have a game with the police department, though I worked in my counterpart, they were like, you should see the look on their face. But when they first showed up, it was for the first half of the game, it was really kind of so-so. But by the end of the game, it was great. And in fact, the police department had come back a couple more times afterwards, and it was just like a regular other village team coming in to visit. It worked out pretty well.
Great, great. And you said you also did gardening. So was that something that they were doing anyways, or was this a new thing, or were you introducing new varieties of vegetables? What was that all about?
Basically, what happens is there were certain some people were doing low level vegetable gardening, and what happens was they had tried to do some vegetable gardenings in the past, but they had troubles with white flies, especially damaging the. So they had lost faith in it. So what happens was I was able to work with, they had an agricultural extension government department, and so we started working with them and just trying to overcome it. And it did. It took 2 years, but we were able to get it where they could have vegetable gardens fairly well.
Great. And what kind of vegetables were they growing?
The regular plain tomatoes, green peppers, stuff that they could bring to the marketplace and sell.
And you also said that you promoted girls' soccer. So were you working with other volunteers for this, or was this just you and your village?
It started off with just me in the village. And it was one young, brave man in the village who was willing to be the coach of the girls' soccer team. And when the girls went out to practice at first, all the people, all the men and the boys were just looking at it and laughing and making fun of it. But I was lucky that in another, somewhere in my area, there was another female volunteer who was in a village that was a little bit more progressive, and she had a girls' soccer team. So we ended up playing together, and it really changed. After that one game, girls' soccer was established in that village.
Wow, that's really amazing. I mean, these are like small things that have a huge impact, don't you think?
Oh, I do. And I was really fortunate that I was followed by another volunteer, and he was nice enough to send me a picture of the girls' soccer team with full uniforms about a year and a half after I left.
Wow, fabulous. Now, you told me once that in every place you went, or I don't know if that's still true, but when you got to Senegal, which was your next place, you planted a specific tree with a red bloom. What was that called?
Yeah, flamboyant.
A flamboyant tree.
What happens was that's not a tree that gives fruit, and it doesn't really give much shade, but it was a tree. And what I felt was that it was a good-looking tree, and it helped brighten the village up, and I was hoping it would, you know, brighten people up and make them feel better. Mm-hmm. And they asked me why I was planting it, and it just came to me. I said, look, the reason why every time it blooms, you'll remember of me. And that's what I used. And they bought it, and so they planted it.
Great. And did it bloom while you were there?
No, it bloomed afterwards.
Wow. And isn't that kind of cool?
But you know what was good about it? Because, again, the volunteer that followed me in Senegal and the volunteer that followed me in El Salvador, I got a message from them to saying that people are talking about me because the tree was blooming.
That's fantastic. That's wonderful. So now we're going to move on to Senegal. Did you go directly from El Salvador to Senegal?
It was about 2.5 months between El Salvador and Senegal.
But you applied while you were in El Salvador?
Yes, I did.
Now, did you go through the regular application process, or was there like an expedited process since you were a volunteer already, or what?
Yeah, it's what I did. I was able to apply for an extension. So I actually did an extension never really left the Peace Corps. I just extended from El Salvador to Senegal.
But you said it was 2.5 months between the two. Did you go back home?
Yeah, I went home for 2.5 months.
Uh-huh. And how was that? That was your first time going back, and you have that reverse culture shock that everybody talks about. So how did that go?
Yeah, it was also the dead of winter, too. So it was, you know, a little bit, people had warned me about the reverse culture shock. And, you know, of course, at first you see going from a land of nothing to a land of plenty, and you just have to have patience and tolerance with the people, and just got to have to understand it.
Yeah. So you were off to Senegal. Can you tell me a little bit about your experience there?
It was really good. I was really lucky to be in the village I was in. I had a really great counterpart, and he was motivated, and it made it really easy to get projects going. We would sit down and discuss projects and come up with ideas. I was really, really blessed to have a counterpart like him.
And you were also in agroforestry there.
Yes, I was in agroforestry and did a lot of community development over there.
So tell me about your typical day in your village in Senegal. Tell me about your living arrangements and, you know, who was around and what did you do when you got up in the morning and so on.
Well, I lived in a hut within a compound of the family of my counterpart. So I had a little hut away from everybody else, round, with a grass roof and mud walls. And I was lucky. I actually had a floor, and I had a cement floor. So that was like an upgrade from El Salvador.
You were in the compound, in the family compound.
Yeah. And usually in the morning, I'd wake up and first thing, just step out. Of course, you know, greeting people and having your coffee and all that. And then it depends. At the beginning, it was really just getting out and just doing the old hitting the pavement, so to speak, and walking around and trying to meet people and get them to be comfortable with me. After, once I had been there for a while, I was usually waking up in the morning and there was some small projects to do or just checking on projects or going around and looking for opportunities.
What kind of projects and opportunities were you looking for?
Well, I was looking for anything that would help the community. And some of the ones I found that worked well were gardening, getting involved with the school, with sports. Of course, we had the tree nursery going. And anything that people would want, health, we worked a little bit on health. That would keep you going. That would keep you busy.
Mm-hmm. What kind of health-related projects did you work on?
Well, over there, most of it was people would get infections from small cuts from working in the field. And some of them would just fester and would take them out. So we just did simple things of trying to teach them how to mend wounds, clean them right away. And that worked out really well.
Uh-huh. Did the people have money to purchase medical supplies? How did that work?
No, they didn't. They didn't have very much. So what we did is, with my counterpart, we created a small little pharmacy. We bought some bandage material and gauze and some antibiotic cream. And you know, some of it I would, you know, pay for myself. And every so often we might get a little, you know, ask somebody for a little bit of money. But it wasn't very expensive. For the price, really, we're able to go far with a small amount of money.
So was with your counterpart that you did that?
Yes, I did, yeah. Uh-huh. Started with the counterpart.
And so was he then dispensing medical help, or were people just taking a little bit of goop and putting it on their finger? How did that work? How was the process of when somebody had a cut or whatever, did they come to him?
Yes, it did. That's how we handled it instead of people just doing it themselves. So we had him, and then we actually trained some teenagers to be able to bandage wounds and clean them. And so it worked pretty well. Anytime anybody had an issue, they would bring them. Even the young kids, they would send their young children, and everybody knew after a while it was just normal. It was a normal thing to do. It worked out pretty well.
And did that, was that sort of self-sustaining? Did they continue that after you left, do you know?
That I don't know.
Uh-huh.
But I had a feeling that they did. Because they did end up building a health clinic in that village. So mm-hmm. I would imagine that it would continue.
Mm-hmm. So I had the privilege of meeting you during that tour in Senegal, and I remember it as a fantastic experience, and I think it was also in part due to the other volunteers who were there. I mean, it was a fabulous group that we were involved in, don't you think?
Oh, it was really a fantastic group, fantastic people. That's one of the reasons why I really enjoyed being in the Peace Corps, not only for you know, the places I was in and the villages I was in, but also for the volunteers that I've met over the years.
So what was your interaction with some of the other volunteers? Can you tell us a little bit about if you saw them frequently, what kind of things you did with them?
Well, in my area, several of us volunteers were in a few miles radius of each other. And what we did, we would visit here and there, but we also did create a Friday morning egg sandwich meeting, and we would go down to like the nearest town, and I can't remember, like maybe 9 o'clock on a Friday morning, we would be able to get together, and it was a good opportunity to vent or to discuss or to share ideas.
And you talk about venting. that's a big thing in Peace Corps, so tell me a little bit about that and, you know, your frustrations and whatever. What kinds of things were people venting about?
Well, most of it, we're different people from a different culture, and when you move into a different culture and you don't really understand it right away, and it does create frustrations, and people aren't doing what you think they should be doing, and things like that. And so, and we're from a society where we have to get things done. We have just a few years to do it in, and there usually things went at a much slower pace, and that I found was most of the topics of venting.
Mm-hmm. And also, obviously, you were different for being a different color in Senegal. So was there a term that people used to call you, to identify you?
Oh, yes. It was Tubaco.
And what
we were in the Pula area, and we went into the Wolof area. We were Tubabo.
Yes, which is sort of derived from the word tabib, which is Arabic for doctor, and the doctors used to be white people. That's the root of it, from what I gather.
Oh, I didn't know, yeah.
Yeah. So that was you would get that as you were riding your bike through the town or whatever.
Oh, yeah. I mean, when you were in your village, you were just, it was better. But when you drove your bicycle to other villages or other areas, you would have 30, 40 children, running at you, tubab, from you can't even see them. They're so small, from almost a quarter of a mile away, kind of running at you. And, and at the time, we're not used to be calling names, so it was a little bit difficult. But once you got used to it, it was actually kind of a cute thing to see.
Yeah. And it would also depend on your mood, whether you were having a good day or bad day, I suppose.
Oh, definitely, definitely. Sometimes it's it was a shame that you would vent on a person who just happened to be that one that just triggered you that day. I was so bad about that.
Uh-huh. All right. So what was one of the hardest things you dealt with in Senegal?
Yeah, one of the hardest things I dealt with was the deaths, basically from malaria of the babies and things like that.
Were there a lot in your village?
There were a few. Uh-huh. Probably more than what they should have been.
Uh-huh. Did you attend funerals?
Oh, yes. Quite a few.
Uh-huh. My recollection of the funerals were the wailing of the women. That's when you knew something. The minute there was a death, you could hear a wail go up. Whether it was in the middle of the day or at night, you would hear that. And that, to me, was just so almost blood-curdling in a way.
I remember the first time I heard it, I was actually visiting my neighbor Pat's village, and we had a little river between us, and I just came back over the river on the boat, and I just got out, and almost maybe a quarter of a mile before I got into the village, I heard this wailing, and I'm like, what is going on? I was like, and then I got there, and oh my God, and I just sat there staring at the ground. It's it really is. It's a surreal. For the first time, it was a real surreal experience.
Mm-hmm. And what were some of the happier moments you had? I think you also worked with soccer, with your village girls. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yep. When my village girls, I think it was almost the best team. So when they won, they beat everybody. It was actually pretty good.
Mm-hmm. Is there another moment that you remember as being just an amazing moment, that either...
Yeah, I think what happens is I worked on gardening, and when I got there, there was 28 compounds, so basically 28 different families, and there were only two doing gardens. So I created a garden and used it as a tool to motivate, and it did. People would come in and people would talk. But when I left, I went down and all 28 compounds had a garden when I left.
Explain that demo garden you had. I thought it was very clever. Can you kind of describe it?
Yeah, I was going to start a garden. They wanted to start a garden for the family. And my counterpart came in with me and he was doing it with me. And I told him, I said, look, I know I want your help, but could you just let me do it myself? And the reason why is I wanted to do a tubab garden. And I was hoping that if I did something different, it would create interest. And it did. And many times I was just working in the garden, and I had my back, and I turned around, and I would get scared because somebody was standing behind me, and people that I had never really even talked to, but they started talking about the garden. Why did I do this? Why did I do that?
You had set it up near the well. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I set up near the well, and what happens is people would wash up near the well. The water was just running everywhere. So what we did is we built a little concrete slab, and I cut channels in the ground, and that wastewater just went through, and it irrigated the garden.
So you had this garden right next to the well. Was it around the well, or was it just right next to it?
It was right next to it, maybe about 3 feet from the well.
Mm-hmm. And so you had created all these canals, these little channels for the water to go through.
110 yards worth.
110 yards. That's quite huge, actually. And what plants did you grow in there?
All the vegetables, except for lettuce, basically tomatoes, eggplants, peppers, the regular ones.
It seemed to me you also had a banana tree, did you not?
Yeah, we did have banana trees. Yeah, my counterpart, he brought a banana tree over, and we put banana trees in there, too. Thanks for reminding me.
Yeah, I remember it being a very beautiful garden and really very clever in using the wastewater as an irrigation system, because that was year-round. That was daily, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. And, you know, another part, too, is people who would get married in the village, they would go into the middle of the garden to take pictures.
Aha. Uh-huh. So it became a tourist attraction.
Kind of. And it also became a target for cows who would jump over the fence in the middle of the
Uh-oh.
Night.
Those cows, those were the nefarious animal to all the gardens.
Oh, my God, yes.
Yeah. Okay, so we're going to move out of Senegal. Where did you go next?
Next, I went to Romania.
Well, that's very different.
Yes, it was. I asked for Thailand again, but I was too late in my solicitation for Thailand. So I guess I wasn't meant to be to go to Thailand.
Maybe you'll retire there eventually.
Yeah, inshallah.
So you ended up in Romania, which is so far removed from Senegal. How was that? And you went directly, right? Or did you have a...
Well, it was 6 months. It was 6 months between tours there.
Okay, so you went back home.
Yes, I went back home 6 months. Again, dead of winter.
In the dead of winter. Perfect timing. All right.
Oh, yeah.
So then you go to Romania. Where were you in Romania?
I was in the extreme western area in a small town called Nalac, right on the border of Hungary. In fact, it was a customs town, border town.
Wow. So there was a lot of traffic back
and
forth.
Yeah, there was a lot of traffic, a lot of trucks.
Mm-hmm. So this was more of a, not urban, but more urbanized situation, was it not?
Well, this is a beautiful, small little town right on the border.
Uh-huh.
Almost a postcard town, it really was.
You said it was beautiful. What was beautiful about it?
Oh, the town square, they had the old churches and the older buildings and with some color. It was really, really, really nice, really quaint.
Mm-hmm.
You had pelicans on top of the telephone poles in their nest, too.
Wow. So what was the population there?
It was about 10,000.
Okay, so much bigger than your village in Senegal, which was like 200 or something, or 300?
Yeah, Senegal was 300.
Okay. So you were going in a bigger way there. So what kind of, what were you hired to do? What was your job?
My sector was organizational development sector. And basically, I was supposed to go into this organization and help them manage themselves and all that. But when I got there, it was 11 people in this organization, and 11 people wanted to do 11 different things. So it was really difficult. So I had to go out and find another area to actually get something accomplished in.
So you didn't end up working with this organization?
No, I didn't.
Okay. So what did you end up doing then?
I ended up actually working in organizational development, but I ended up working with the Roma community.
Uh-huh. Tell us a little bit about that. Who are the Roma and what was the deal there?
Well, you know, the Roma, the unpolitically correct term of gypsy. So what happens was when I arrived in Romania, they were entering the European Union at the time. And one of the directors of the European Union was to have integration of the minorities. And so what they wanted to do was they made a specific post of liaison between the Roma community and the mayor's office. So I ended up working. They were able to choose one person with a high school education that was willing to do the job, so I worked with him.
Wonderful. So who was this person? Did he end up being your counterpart?
Yeah, he ended up basically, he didn't. One of the 11 of the original group actually became a counterpart, watched over me, but the Roma man was the one that I dealt with daily.
At the mayor's office?
Yes.
And the mayor's office, can you describe that? Was it a big place? Was it a kind of a country-style place? What was it like?
It was actually small, but enough to handle a town of 10,000 people.
So what kind of, office equipment was there? Were they well established? I mean, was it modern? Was it rudimentary?
For the time, yeah, it was rudimentary, but they did have computers, and they weren't new computers, but they were capable computers at the time. So they were pretty much with it, more or less.
So did you spend much time in that office, or what did you spend your time doing?
I spent most of my time in actually the Roma community, but mostly at the Roma man's house, because I was teaching him computer skills and other skills like that that actually he was able to use when he was on the job.
So this was the young man who had the basic high school education?
Yes, yep.
Uh-huh. And so he was Roma, and then you say you spent time in the Roma community. Were they quote-unquote ghettoized, or were they all over town? Was there a center? How did that manifest itself?
Yeah, there was a neighborhood, basically a Roma neighborhood. And as I went there, as I was in this man's house was in the middle of the neighborhood, and so there was a local bar hangout. And so we would work, but would also spend some time in that hangout, and I was able to meet a bunch of people. And really, that was more of just integrating. That's what that was about, integrating in the Roma community.
So you hung out there for several days, weeks, or whatnot, and then you started to get to know people.
Yeah. But the most of the work I did was with this Roma man. We used to spend a couple hours every day going over things and any questions. And we also organized a Roma culture dance troupe, too, through it also. We worked on that on the side.
Whose idea was that? That's fantastic. Whose idea was that?
I think it was more of a collaboration, because we ended up sitting down, speaking about it, and then I was like, why don't we have one? And so it just went from there.
How did you end up speaking about it? Is it something that was a part of the culture that was really a dominant part of the culture, this dancing? Or
yeah, it was. It was a in the town that I was in, it was a mostly multi-ethnic town. It was Romanian, it was Slovakian, it was Hungarian, and each one had their specific culture dance troupe. That Roma didn't have it, and so I was, I'm like, why don't you? And so we were able to put something together, found a group of young people who were willing to do it, and off we went.
So off you went, and how did that go? What did you do?
It worked out really well, because at first, the mayor's office helped fund culture groups, and people were skeptical of the Roma, and so they weren't sure they were going to actually do it. But this mayor was my next door neighbor's friend, and I was able to sit down with him and discuss it on the side. The Roma man never knew what I was doing, but I was discussing to him how it would make him look good in the eyes of the European Union.
Oh, good.
Back up all ethnicities, and he bought it, and it did work well.
Yeah.
And he actually became, his credit, he did become a defender of my of the Roma man inside the office, who took some discrimination, and he also was willing to support the Roma community.
So there was a lot of behind-the-scenes stuff going on.
Yeah, over there definitely was.
Uh-huh. So tell me about your living situation. Were you with a family, or did you have your own place?
Yeah, I had my own place. I was the family lived next door, and it was the mother-in-law's house, and I think she had passed, so it was available. So I was able to get it, and it was old, but it was nice. It was comfortable. It was traditional. It was a traditional Romanian house.
Traditional, and how so? Can you describe it?
Yeah, it was all. It's kind of a bit ornate with the cement work. You had to put wood into the boiler to get hot water for a shower.
Oh, wow.
And, and it had a big ceramic heater that you would look like a ceramic block that you would put heat into it, and you would heat up all the tiles, and then you would shut it off, and the heat would just radiate overnight.
And that was all wood fed?
Oh, actually, I was pretty fortunate. The water tank was wood fed, but the big ceramic heater was gas fed.
Okay, so you had a gas line coming in. Or yep. Was it a gas tank that you had to swap out?
It was a gas line.
So it was a fairly comfortable situation. You had room and you had privacy. I recall you had a blog. Do you remember your blog address, if anybody wants to have a look at it, from Romania? Because you had posted a lot of things.
You know, no, I don't have it with me right now.
You don't
now.
Remember. Don't, all right. Well, head, I'll find it. Is it okay if I share it with people?
Oh, please, please.
Okay, so I'll find it for them. In any case, I remember seeing pictures of you making sausages and stuff like that.
Yeah, that was the next door neighbor. They were great. They had a farm, and they had their own pigs, and they would slaughter the pigs, and they would make it. It was all from scratch, from the beginning to end. And the sausages they made were specific to this region. And, in fact, I don't know how it happened, but whenever a representative of the president of Romania would come by, he would always stop by my neighbor's house and grab some sausages.
So he was famous in a way.
Yeah, yeah. It was amazing. Of course, I doubt, you know, they paid for them, but I mean, but it was, yeah.
But it was an honor.
Sausage. Yes, it was.
Uh-huh. Cool. So did you do a lot with this neighbor?
No, not really. They were busy. My main work was with that Roma man, and you know, with the Roma and the discrimination they had, I was basically the only one that was, you know, willing to go into the Roma community and spend time with them.
Mm-hmm. What ended up happening with your dance troupe? Were there competitions or were there big festivals?
Well, they would every year they would have what they call Zili the Nadlak, which was a Nadlak day. It's a big day in the middle of the town when they would have food and cultural dance troupes, and it was, I believe it was for 2 days, and it was a really big thing. The people from different countries would come. So the first year, the Roma dance troupe wasn't organized, but the second year it was, and they were able to get up there and they danced. And also, they were able to somehow, through that, through actually being out there, they were actually able to get a trip to go from our village in Nadlak to Constanța, which is totally on the eastern side. We were on the border of on the west, and they're definitely on the border of the east on the Black Sea. But they went over there for a Roma symposium.
Uh-huh. So you kind of activated a lot of things for the Roma community.
I tried to.
Mm-hmm. And if you were to sum up your experience in Romania, what was the most important or meaningful thing for you?
To me, it was to be able to get actually leave with feeling that I had accomplished something. And seeing that the Roma, this man was working well and being accepted and able to, you know, do his work in a really efficient manner, and where the mayor and the mayor's office was accepting, and you could see that there was something actually moving in a positive direction. I felt really good with that.
Great. So you ended on a good note, and then what happened next? Where did you go, and how did that happen?
I extended again, and I ended up going to Namibia.
Namibia, so back to Africa.
Back to Africa.
And shock to the system, not shock to the system?
This is a shock to the system because in Romania, I was in a village that had almost like a mini McDonald's. And to going out to Namibia, where I was 50 miles from the nearest one store and 125 miles in one direction to 140 miles in the other direction to any town. So, yeah, it was a difference. It was a big difference.
So you were back in a very small village.
Yeah, this one was about 800 people.
Oh, so not so small.
Not so small, no.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it was a settlement. It was from the San people, San Bushman people.
Mm-hmm.
With the government, and it was inside the Boaboata National Park, a game reserve. And what the government wanted to do was to take the San out of the bush and put them into the settlement so that they could create the actual game reserve where they would actually do some hunting, legal hunting.
Uh-huh. So game reserve, do they have the big five, as they call them? What do they have there?
No hippos. It was no hippos, but definitely elephants and giraffes and lions, but not in my area. In the park, but not uh-huh. in my area.
So was this area flat or was it hilly? Can you tell me?
Yeah, this was flat. It was definitely flat, like a plain.
So very hot?
It became hot. But also in the winter, for about 2 or 3 weeks, it was really, really cold in the morning. Mm-hmm. Everybody have to go outside and sit in the sun.
Uh-huh. So there again, you were trained and you were working in a different field, I think.
Yeah, I was in the health sector here. In Namibia at the time, it was about 17% HIV. And out there to do HIV, awareness. Mm-hmm. And, of course, like anything else, it always ends up with doing some community service, too.
Mm-hmm. So the HIV awareness and prevention, what kind of activities did you do, and what kind of populations were you targeting?
Over there, you do things like having soccer games, with HIV, and, people would stand up before the game and in the middle of the halftime and give some, how to protect yourself. And I was lucky to be in a rural health clinic that did have a television and a DVD player and a small solar panel. And what we did was we made small movies in the local language and with HIV prevention in mind. Multiple partners, teenage pregnancy. We even made it in the sign language and on how important it is to continue to take your ARVs.
So one of the official languages is English, no?
Yes, it is. Yes.
Okay, so you had that to rely on, because, learning the local language and doing HIV prevention in the local language would have been a real challenge.
Oh, definitely. That's why I worked with the... by making the movies, and the movies could be played over and over again, mm-hmm. While the people were just sitting waiting for their appointments.
So who was in the movies, and who were you getting involved in that?
The people inside the clinic. I tell you, they were a pretty good part. Impromptu actors, no script, they were actually pretty good.
So what was the scenario, for example, of one of your movie clips?
One of them would be this man would... cheat on his wife. He was like him and his wife were HIV, negative, and then he cheated on his wife and he became HIV positive, and how he got sick, and he tried to go to a traditional healer, and the traditional healer, would do nothing but like cut you and say prayers over you, and how he died in the hands of the traditional healer.
Mm-hmm. And then the wife became HIV, I suppose, too, no?
Yeah, she did.
So that was a very common scenario in real life there, I would assume.
It was. And uh-huh. We did on polio, how to take polio. And then that one was actually a scenario that did happen in the village. So we just duplicated it.
Well, that must have been very close to their heart and stuff. That must have been a bit of a difficult thing for them, no?
Well, no, it was interesting because I didn't know when we first put it together. But then later, it was only a 10-minute film. And then once we played it, everybody goes, oh, yeah, that happened here just like 15 years ago or something like that. I had no idea.
Oh, so you found out after the fact.
Yeah.
Okay. Were you doing the camera? How was that working? How did the films, how were they made?
Well, what we did was, because to sit down and write a script with everybody at the time, and it just wasn't what they did. So well, we'd sit around, we were on a slow time, and we'd say, okay, we're going to make a movie, and... we're going to make a movie about what? Polio. And so we would sit together, and I was a Namibian, so I didn't really know, exactly what would click in their culture. So I just sat down and said, okay, we need a beginning, we need a middle, and we need an end. And so we would sit there sometimes for days, and we'd sit there sometimes for hours, and then we'd just discuss it, and then everyone would choose their role, and they would just basically speak about what they would do and how it would flow. And then when it started, it was like, there was no hesitations. It was just like the movie it was like you wrote a script and they studied their lines. To me, I thought it was amazing. And I worked the camera, and I didn't even understand almost nothing of what they were saying. So
they were directing themselves and writing the whole thing themselves.
Yeah. I just edited it at the end.
What kind of equipment were you using for that?
I just had a small Canon camera, and I had my little... laptop with a XP, and I was able to burn a disk. That's how we did.
What were you editing on XP?
I was using Windows Movie Maker.
There you go.
And it worked. It worked really. I mean, I'm not a professional filmmaker, but it worked really well. And they actually brought it up to to the nearest hospital. We had a hospital 50 miles away, and they were showing it in that hospital, too.
Uh-huh. And that's something also that people would have had access to, I would think, on their computers, no?
That's right. But they didn't have computers. A lot of them had batteries and DVD players.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, but we kept playing them in the waiting room while people were sitting there, and it gave them something to do. And it was just some movies they weren't too much, but it was two of them. They must have wore the disc out within 2 weeks because they just kept watching them and watching them. They just loved it.
Mm-hmm. What was your living situation there?
I was living when I got there. There was a in this settlement. It was a little bit more an established. It wasn't new. But they were establishing what I think the goal was to create a town. So there was churches, there was a government services, like as in youth, there was a police department, and I ended up living in the Catholic mission for the first 2 years.
Okay, and did you have a room or what?
Yeah, I had a room. It was a really pretty nice mission. It was like a quad, and it was really, or it was almost like a mini motel.
Uh-huh. So you had a room, and did you do your own cooking, or did you eat with a family?
Yeah, I did my own cooking. What I did was, after a little while, you know, I had a little hot plate, but I built a little solar oven, and I was using that most of the time.
You built a solar oven?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it worked well, because Libya has about an average of 300 days a year of sun, so
uh-huh.
it was a no-brainer.
Did other people have solar ovens?
No, it was funny because when I built it at first, I was telling people what I was building, and nobody believed it. And then one day, I left it at someone's house for them to use, and they cooked rice. And you should see, two or three of the family members came running over trying to show me the rice they cooked, you know? It was pretty funny.
Did you teach them how to build a solar oven for themselves?
I showed them, and I wanted to, but none of them were interested in building
one. Oh, they just wanted to try yours out. They just wanted to try yours out.
Exactly, yep.
So what was one of the best things there, and what was one of the worst things there in Namibia?
The best thing was actually the people that I worked with. They were just great. When you wanted to make the movies, you know, they were no negativity. They were willing, and they were really, really nice, and they participated. And the people in the village themselves really accepted me pretty much. They weren't a big... It wasn't much of a big deal. But the worst part was to try and get the HIV awareness. There was alcohol in the village. And as much as you tried, as many movies and leaving condoms and all the little bars and everything, I was there for 3 years. And when we would have our testing event, you would still see people leaving the room of the results with this look on their face like they contracted HIV. And also there were a lot of people who, for some reason or other, just stopped taking their ARVs, and they were just going to these funerals, too many of them.
Oh. So it was really, you could really feel the presence of AIDS and HIV.
Yeah, it was intense in that part. And it was like, I know that, you know, it's their right to do what they want to do, but it was just, you know, when you're being there, it was to help prevent it and stuff. It was frustrating.
Mm-hmm. And you really feel that alcohol was the big evil in that.
It was, because as soon as they got drunk, it was like nothing. It didn't
no
matter.
No control.
We would leave condoms right in the spot where they were drinking, and it just didn't matter.
Yeah. Hmm. So that was really hard. But you said you stayed 3 years, which is a long time. Normally, it's 2 years and 3 months, I think, is the standard length of service. So why did you extend?
Well, I actually really enjoyed it. Despite, you know, the difficulties and all that stuff, it was really, really a pretty good place to be because of the people. So, and it was actually things going on. You know, as much as we tried to do things, we were able to do a bunch of other little different things.
Mm-hmm.
And a thing that made it really kind of an interesting thing was about 9 months after I arrived in that village, two Romanian men came in to open up a 7-day Adventist church. And I remember being in Romania, which was a tour before Namibia, and I was talking to one of the other volunteers in my group, we left at the same time, and we were both in the airport saying, this is probably the last time we would ever speak Romanian in our whole life. And what happens was, after 9 months in Namibia, I was speaking Romanian for the next 2.5 years afterwards.
Fabulous. And so you dealt with them a lot. You were like seeing old friends.
Yeah, it was. I helped them when they built this church, because they had to redo it. And so it was things like that that made it, I felt, worthwhile to be there. You know, it was opportunities to be involved and help out. It was worth staying.
And you helped build bridges between the local population and them in terms of language and culture, I would assume.
Yeah, we did, yep. Mm-hmm. Especially at the beginning, because I had been in there 9 months before they arrived.
That's kind of cool. So what happened next? I think you came back to the States and stayed in the States for a while.
That's true. When I came back after Namibia, I thought it was going to be my last tour. And I was fighting it. But 16 months later, I went back in.
Tell me a little bit about where you ended up going.
I ended up going into Burkina Faso, back to West Africa.
So did you apply specifically for that? Or?
No, that was, I believe that was just before. I know what I understand now is that you can ask for a specific country in general, but at that time it still wasn't like that. But basically I didn't really care, because I knew that from my reaction to El Salvador, from not getting Thailand, and I knew I was wrong, I knew that basically wherever I was supposed to be, it was supposed, where I was supposed to be, and that I could make something out of it. And the reason why I think I ended up in West Africa again, because I had French.
Uh-huh. So this is like your third African country. So how different was Burkina to Namibia and Senegal?
Well, actually, Burkina was considerably different from Senegal, and more so different than Namibia, because Burkina Faso is approximately, more or less, 50% Muslim and 50% Christian. Mm-hmm. Senegal was, I believe at the time, was 97% Muslim, and Namibia was basically 100% Christian. So, you know, the differences in the religion really made a difference between drinking and not drinking, and, you know, and just basic custom itself.
The basic customs, you're saying?
Yeah, because mm-hmm. down south, in Namibia, drinking was more prevalent, mm-hmm. and you're more open, and seeing more westernized was the right thing. And plus, English maybe had a difference with that, too. We were listening to, like, hip-hop, and things like that. But in West Africa, Senegal was, you know, basically Muslim, and in Burkina Faso, it was 50-50, but Burkina Faso was somewhat more conservative in their religion, even the Christian religion. There really wasn't that much drinking in Burkina Faso within the Christian community.
Uh-huh. So that kind of curtailed any kind of unruly behavior.
Yes, it did. It really did. There was truly a big difference between the drinking, the country that you could drink and the country that you didn't drink, like between Senegal and Namibia. For that reason, there was a lot of violence in Namibia and in the Shabins, you know, the little bar areas where people would just get drunk and break bottles and kill people with it. Mm. Over there, there was a lot of that, a lot more violence, alcohol as a motivator.
So in Burkina, what were you tasked to do?
I was back in the health sector again, and I was in they call it a village, but I would consider like an informal town, because it was about 50 miles south of Ouagadougou, the capital, and it was right on the highway, a main highway, mm-hmm. That went down to Ghana. So lots of traffic, mm-hmm. A big marketplace where people from the capital would come down to buy things and bring it back. And it was not like Senegal, where we were just, you know, basically isolated off the road, by ourselves, no services, we had to do everything ourselves. And Namibia was so far away from anything. That was a difference. So it was more of a small, like I said, informal town. And those were harder to get work done than in an isolated village.
Mm-hmm. And that's because people were distracted or what?
Yeah, they had a lot of their own work. They weren't just farmers. They weren't just agriculturists. They were masons and metal workers and doing a lot of, what did they call it in Senegal? Bana Bana?
Oh, yeah.
You know? Yeah, a lot of
dealing, a lot of wheeling and dealing.
Coming out and buying their goods and shipping it up to the
buying and selling.
Yep.
So there was a lot of commerce going on.
Yeah, there was a lot. They would come down from, big trucks would come down from the capital, and they would just take up the capital and support the capital with the food or whatever they took.
Mm-hmm. So you were in the health sector, and what were the concerns there, health concerns?
The health concerns are mostly basic ones like drinking bad water, we'd call it infections.
Mm-hmm.
There was no HIV wasn't as prevalent there as it was in Namibia.
Mm-hmm.
Malnourishment was also one for the babies, malnourishment.
And that was for the babies, meaning they're not being fed by their moms, or malnourishment beyond the breastfeeding?
I think it was malnourishment beyond the breastfeeding. Part of my job, too, was to help wing the babies, and then if they were considered malnourished, they would get some of these bars they called, a puppy nut or something like that, and they would, try and, they would take them home and try and feed them. It was really nutritious and a lot of calories, and it seemed like it was peanut butter based, so
uh-huh.
I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think those are the same ones that they distribute in refugee camps.
Yeah, they're really full of calories.
Mm-hmm. So that was very different from your previous services. What kind of things did you learn, or what was interesting about it?
To me, it was more of a people would still, talk to you and things, and but they left me alone a little bit more there. It wasn't as much, you didn't hit two bob all the time, or
did they kind of ignore you?
No, not really, but they weren't so in your face. Or when you did, we did meet me, there was more of a discussions and not just like, here you are, can you give me money type
okay.
thing,
All right. So what kind of stuff did you do? What were some of the projects that you worked on? And were you at the clinic all the time? Were you based out of a clinic?
Yeah, I was based out of the clinic. I actually had a room, and what they did is they had built a brand new building for the clinic, and I was they still had the old original small clinic, so I had a room inside there. And most of my work was to basically the health education, but in the outlying villages, with each village had a health relay, they called them. So I would, the ones that were willing to work, maybe there was about three of them. So actually, I spent a lot of time out there, bicycling out there and just hanging out too. Of course, part of it is to, integrate into the village instead of just showing up out of nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
And each one had a small school, so most of it was going in and teaching the children about washing their hands and to stay hydrated and try and drink clean water and, and to clean infections.
Mm-hmm. And what was the language that you spoke there?
French. Basically, it was French, but the predominant language in that area was Moré.
Moré?
And Moré, yeah.
And did you learn that?
Some of it. I forgot a lot of it, but enough to, tell them where I'm going and basically what I'm doing, but to be able to do any education, no, more than that. A lot of times the teachers would translate, but in the school, the children were French, so it was a little bit easier.
So you were speaking French all the time?
Yeah, I was speaking French all the time. That's one reason why I believe I got Burkina Faso, because I already had French experience.
Mm-hmm. What were some of the difficult experiences that you had there?
Yeah, I think one of the most difficult experiences was being in an informal town, just like being in Romania, into a small town. It's just a little bit more difficult to try and find activities because people were occupied with their types of work and everything, as opposed to being in a village like Senegal, for example, where people were agriculturists and they did agriculture, and then after that they didn't have much of other things to do. So, and there was no government support systems in the village, so basically everything was, we could do everything ourselves in a village. You were more, in a smaller village, it was made more of an impact because you became more of a community member, but in an informal town, it was more difficult to find areas that you could, put your nose in and try and find other different projects.
Mm-hmm. Well, did you befriend people and did you end up working with them more than with other people, or what?
Yeah, I did. It was a couple of health relays who were really, really great people who were, really down to earth and just nice and normal everyday people. And I did most of my work with them. And there were other ones. I think a total out of that health clinic, there was 9 relays for the 9 surrounding villages. And only 4 of them were really willing to do anything, and the other 5 weren't interested.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a lot of Peace Corps experience that we've just been through. So, you know, why did you keep on going, and do you want to do it again?
Well, I kept on going because I was really fortunate that I had great experiences in the villages. After I was there for a while, the people that kind of accepted me, you know, they were listening to me. They were, you know, I mean, they included me. And so I felt really good about it. And so it was easy to go, and I really enjoyed the lifestyle. I liked being in these areas, and I liked, you know, being in these different places with different people, learning different languages, and seeing different cultures and customs. And it was really, to me, I thought it was always exciting.
Mm-hmm. And would you do it again?
I don't know. I think I would, but I don't see anything in the near future.
Mm-hmm. So what are you doing now?
Oh, now I'm retired. I'm kind of out the pasture, I guess, huh?
But you're not, because you're still doing stuff.
Yeah. No, I'm busy. I'm just keeping myself busy, a little part-time job, and spending more time with the family now that the family's a little bit older, and they're also retired. They have more time, so we get together more.
Uh-huh. And you're also learning languages, new languages?
Yeah, I just, from being in the Peace Corps, I found I had learned French when I was in grammar school, but there was never any need to use it. And so I didn't really understand what language could do and how much fun it could be. But after being in the Peace Corps, and especially in El Salvador, with learning Spanish and struggling it and getting to a point and then finding out that, you know, you could really communicate with different people and open up and find out different things. And I found that, you know, learning a language was useful and really, really was a joy to be able to have people to integrate you into these things, and you could only do it through language.
Mm-hmm.
So I just got this big love for language now, and so I just keep going and I just enjoy it.
Mm-hmm. And both you and I entered Peace Corps at an older age. How old were you when you first went in?
I was 48 when I started. It was 48. It was at that point of life, and I was just wanted to go somewhere, and I wanted to get going, and I was basically free at the time. I had a family when I was young, and they were all growing up on their own, and it seemed like it was the right time.
Uh-huh. Well, Paul, I really appreciate you talking to me, and I think you will be the source of inspiration to some people out there listening.
Oh, geez.
And I think so. Anyways, it was really great. I really appreciate it. And that's it, I guess. Thanks for calling.
I appreciate it.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, I hope this gave you a little glimpse of what you can possibly accomplish when you are in the Peace Corps. It is an experience that is very personal and diverse, and everybody's experience is unique. If you're curious about Paul's experiences in Romania or Namibia, I've included a couple of links on the WHUS page where this episode resides. Visit whus.org and search for The Process. I would like to thank WHUS Stores for making this podcast possible and the students and staff who've helped me along the way. Next on The Process, we will be speaking to Kazimiera Koslowski, formerly the director of the Prudence Crandall Museum in Canterbury. Hope you tune in.